Welcome to Claim Stories, actual accounts of professional liability claims against Ontario licensed architects, chosen from the 6,000 or so cases defended by Prodemnity Insurance Company. The Prodemnity Claim Stories were originally written by David Croft. The stories are factual, but some elements have been altered to protect the identity of all parties involved, the guilty as well as the innocent. Architectural practice, it seems, can be far more exciting than most people imagine. But in architecture, as in life, the wrong kind of excitement can be perilous. In the 1967 film Cool Hand Luke, the chain gang captain informs his crew that their problems all stem from one simple cause: failure to communicate. The same may be said of the participants in the following three stories. A simple exchange of information, promptly delivered, duly recorded, and correctly remembered, might have saved everyone a lot of grief. In this story, the construction of a small office building starts before a permit has been issued, and stops when an error is discovered in the drawings. The building is redesigned and construction begins again, but the new design contains more errors. Keep listening to find out what can happen when a project makes a false start. Arthur Crummidge was a successful accountant and a minor developer of some substance in a small northern Ontario city. He hired architect Nathan Quandary to design a head office for his future business empire. The building design, which was discussed at great length, featured windows on all four sides, allowing a flexible internal layout with daylight pouring into every office. Eager to get started, Crummidge hired a construction manager and work began, even before a building permit was issued. A short while later, trouble arrived in the form of a building inspector with a stop work order. Site work had already begun, with excavation completed and footings in place. But not only had no building permit been issued, no permit could be issued because one of the glazed walls clearly contravened regulations. The wall in question was located within a few feet of the lot line, so it needed to be a fire separation wall, built of non-combustible material. In addition, any glazing that might have been contemplated on that wall would have to include an expensive, specially designed fire shutter system. To comply with the building code, the architect had subsequently redesigned the building, and construction was now completed. Then, the legal trouble began. Crummidge, the owner and developer, and now plaintiff, alleged that he would not have proceeded with the design had he known that windows were not permitted in one of the longer walls. But the cost of starting over, relocating the building away from the lot line, and then going through the 3-month site planning process all over again, had forced him to accept the windowless wall. But there was another problem as well, one that became glaringly obvious when the structure was completed. The ceilings were too low. Office buildings should have ceiling heights of 9 feet or more. But in this building, most ceiling heights were only 8 feet, and no allowance had been made for ductwork beneath the wood joists. So in some areas, the headroom was reduced even more. These unsatisfactory conditions had reduced the value of the owner's investment, and the wall fiasco had cost him precious time. As for starting without a permit, he stated that he had only allowed the work to begin because the architect had told him that it would be all right. As if these problems weren't enough, his final complaint was that his business reputation had been severely damaged. It all added up to $1 million, for which the owner was suing the architect. In his plea, the architect, Quandary, denied it all. He had not realized that the property line was so close because the adjacent lot, a parking lot for a fast food franchise, was also owned by Crummidge. Furthermore, it was the owner's decision, not the architect's, to proceed with the windowless wall, knowing that he could have relocated the building. Admittedly, some delay would have been involved. As for the ceiling heights, he said that the owner was not inexperienced, and since the floor-to-floor heights were clearly shown on the drawings, he should have been aware of them. The ductwork was another matter. As part of the design-build contract, the architect was not involved in mechanical matters at all. In fact, he had suggested to the owner that he hire a mechanical engineer. The lack of windows, he claimed, was hardly an issue. Very few offices were affected, and anyway, Accountants are accustomed to working in semi-open cubicles without windows, aren't they? As a final point, the architect stated that he had not told the owner to start construction without a permit and was unaware that he had done so. The matter proceeded through discoveries. Based on an analysis of the evidence and testimony produced, ProDemnity concluded that the grossly inflated amount of the claim and the self-serving appraisals produced by the plaintiff to bolster his alleged loss were insupportable. That said, the architect was not wholly credible either. This was a small city, and it was impossible to imagine that he was completely unaware that the construction was underway. When interviewed by the ProDemnity Council, the owner's construction manager, Ed Ruff, supported most of the architect's claims, but his story regarding the permit was somewhat at odds with the architect's version. It was on the architect's advice, he said, that the construction had started before the permit was issued. Although the architect bore clear responsibility for the location error, which resulted in some delay, the other issues were entirely defensible. The plaintiff responded with the inevitable posturing, but in the end, ProDemnity successfully defended the architect's position and settled the matter for a small fraction of the original claim, well within the limits of his professional liability policy. In a small town, it might seem harmless and entirely natural to set aside big city protocols in favor of small town etiquette. But as we learn from this story, architects have a duty of care that they are obliged to uphold, regardless of locale, urban, suburban, or rural. And failure to observe that duty is not just bad practice. It can also lead to costly errors. Lesson number one. With the exception of certain permissible startup activities, building without a permit is imprudent and illegal. Lesson number two. Be aware of the exact boundaries of your site by making sure you have a valid survey. It is unwise to just take your client's word for it, even if, or especially if, your client owns the adjacent properties. Lesson number three. When dealing with an experienced client, be careful about letting your guard down. In this case, the client was a seasoned developer and should have been aware that errors were being committed. An architect's duties include protecting clients against themselves. Lesson number four. Be sure to have signed agreements in place before any work begins. In this case, all sorts of oral promises were claimed, but the defense was impeded by the lack of an architect-client agreement. The informal arrangements reflected the relaxed small-town environment, but blurred the roles of the parties, including that of the construction manager. As suggested at the beginning, you may very easily find yourself in circumstances similar to these. Remember these four lessons and take care. False starts can often lead to unfortunate finishes. In this story, an architect forgets that he is the agent of the owner during the bid process. He compounds the problem by making decisions without the owner's knowledge and consent, and then fails to put them in writing. This leads to an unfortunate situation that we call Les Misérables. Joseph and Paul Ward were professors in a university town in Ontario. Roger Tassett was an architect who specialized in residences. The Wards had hired Tassett to do a home renovation for an agreed budget of around $300,000. The project was put out to tender, and bids were received by the architect at his own office. The bids for construction of the project ranged from $240,000 to $350,000. The bottom bid was surprisingly low, but the second lowest bid, at $320,000, was right on budget. When the architect called the low bidder to tell him how low he was, the bidder confessed to having made an error. For the architect, a red flag went up. This contractor had been invited to submit despite having a reputation of being financially unstable. So, acting on instinct and without further investigation, the architect decided to ignore his $240,000 bid and award the contract to the second lowest bidder instead. A claim and a lawsuit followed. In a pretrial hearing, the owners stated their case simply. Their architect should not have acted on his own and kept them in the dark about this important decision. If they had been told about the low bid, they would probably have insisted on accepting it, saving themselves $60,000. But they only found out about it after the tender period had expired, too late to do anything except to sign with the second lowest bidder. A short while after signing, the low bidder informed the owners that they had been scalped. His mistake was only worth $25,000, not $60,000, so they had been duped. The owners liked the renovated house. They had no complaints about the work. They just wanted their money back. In his defense, the architect explained his decision to Prodemnity. He believed that signing with a bidder who had made an error of this magnitude would be a recipe for certain disaster. The price was, in his words, crazy low, and the extras required to make up what the bid had overlooked, combined with the resultant corner cutting, would have made the job a nightmare. He felt that he had no choice but to reject the low bid. Furthermore, the architect denied that he had failed to inform the owners of his decision. He clearly remembered mentioning the low price and the reasons for the rejection because it had happened on a special occasion. He, his wife, and his clients were enjoying a drink during the intermission of the local production of Les Misérables. He had explained everything right there at the lobby bar, and he could not recall any objections. This was how he always worked. He believed in informal, friendly relationships with his clients and never had problems with oral communications in the past. The judge at pretrial was unsympathetic. He gave short shrift to the architect's explanations. It was the architect's duty, as agent of the owner, to keep his clients informed, in writing, of the bids and any phone calls relating to the low bidder's alleged error. Decisions were the owner's to make, not the owner's agent. It was negligent of the architect to deliver such important matters in a noisy bar, in an environment of verbal confusion. Meanwhile, during discovery, the plaintiff's counsel had done some Perry Mason-style digging and was able to produce the ticket stubs for the performance of Les Misérables that the four litigants had attended. It was clear from the date on the tickets that the show and the alleged conversation took place weeks after the contract had been signed with the second lowest bidder, not before. This did not improve the judge's view of the architect's credibility. The pre-trial judge felt that, as pleaded, the architect had no case and that $60,000, the full difference, would be a reasonable settlement amount, recognizing that the architect had erred. Since the error was not malicious, no punitive or other damages were warranted. During interviews and questioning by Prodemnity, the architect had been utterly convinced of the correctness of his position. He truly believed that he had the right to bury the low bid. After all, the job had gone well. The clients were pleased and had become family friends. That is, until the lawsuit. The disclosure of the theater ticket mix-up had left the architect speechless, but he passed it off as an innocent memory lapse. He had meant well, and in fact, the owners had benefited by his action or inaction. The renovation was done well and on budget. At worst, he had acted too paternally. The owners had claimed twice the cost difference and had rejected earlier settlements offered by Prodemnity, offers made, incidentally, over the objections of the architect, who believed that justice would triumph in the end. In other words, he would win. Prodemnity settled the matter successfully and equitably for the pre-trial judge's recommended amount, the price difference between the lowest and second lowest bids. But we regret to report that the architect continued to believe that an injustice was done. According to him, the judge was wrong. We should not have settled. The architect in this story failed to get the message, but the rest of us can benefit from two important lessons. Lesson number one, never forget that you are the owner's agent. The owner has the power to decide on all matters. If you disagree with your client, you have the right to withdraw your services. Lesson number two. This architect's failure to keep written records led to a pitiable situation involving unnecessary confusion and unhappiness. For any decision, large or small, Make written notes and have your client sign off on them. Important matters should not be left to the fog of memory. After a few months, no one can distinguish between what they wish they had said and what they had actually said. In fact, why not keep a diary with notes on both professional and social events? You never know what may turn out to be important. Although the architect in this story attended a performance of Les Misérables, he failed to pick up on one of the story's most important lessons. Victor Hugo put it this way: "Let us study things that are no more. It is necessary to understand them, if only to avoid them." Learn from your mistakes and the mistakes of others, and with a little good fortune, you will avoid finding yourself in a real-life version of Les Misérables. This is a story of poor detailing, poor workmanship, poor business decisions, and a penniless general contractor who flees to Newfoundland. A construction manager prevents an architect from making site inspections, but the owner sues him anyway when the building starts to leak. These circumstances all help to create what might best be called an unhealthy health club. The architect, Hartwell Wonderly, had been engaged to design a hotel tower addition to a residential health club in a resort town near Algonquin Park. The club, a branch of a large health resort corporation specializing in weight loss, boasted lavish facilities and accommodations. The owner-operator of the facility, who was experienced in the hospitality sector, claimed no knowledge of construction, so he had put all his faith in the architect. He was now complaining that the new tower, which had been completed about 2 years previously, leaked like a sieve. As a result, drywall was mildewed and ceilings were falling down. The evidence was plain to see. Both the inside and the outside of the new building showed obvious signs of deterioration. This was ruining the club's upscale image and causing a sizable drop in business. The owner had commissioned a technical audit, which valued the required remedial work, an entire new exterior wall system, at over $1 million. Adding in the business losses and so on, it all amounted to over $2 million. The architect explained to ProDemity that he had very little to do with the actual building process. The owner was a very strong-willed person who had taken charge of every aspect of the work, and to make up for his lack of construction experience, had hired a construction manager, whom he promptly fired. The replacement manager, a more forceful individual, told the architect, in essence, to keep out of his hair. The architect naturally assumed that the owner agreed to these instructions. While the building was under construction, the general contractor had been under great stress. And when his business finally failed, he fled to Newfoundland, where he could not be found when attempts were made to serve him. The architect felt that his drawings were quite adequate, but that the construction manager and the contractor had not followed good practice. The workmanship was appalling, and that was why the problems existed. In any event, the claim was absurdly exaggerated. The defects could easily be remedied with some flashing and caulking. To investigate the matter, ProDemity sent an architect consultant to reconnoiter the facility. Photographs were taken and personnel were interviewed to try to get an idea of the bigger picture. The photographs told the sad story. The exterior walls were a disaster. They had consisted of a quarter inch of acrylic stucco applied to drywall screwed to steel stud backup. With no overhangs or weather protection of any kind, the walls were entirely inadequate for a rugged Canadian climate. There was one incidental but important fact that represented a plus for the defense. According to staff at the facility, business was bad all over. People couldn't afford to lose weight anymore, certainly not in such luxurious surroundings. In any event, there had never been any real demand for the tower rooms. The old building sufficed perfectly. On examining the architect's drawings, we found them very sketchy and lacking in fundamental details. There was little direction as to how vapor barriers, air barriers, through-wall flashings, and the like were to be handled. The roof was also only vaguely indicated. The architect's defense that the construction manager did not want to be fettered with fussy details did not strike the right note. ProDemnity could not possibly have an expert testify that the documents met an acceptable standard, because they didn't. The construction manager was no longer in business, and long gone. He had no insurance and no assets. This was not a huge surprise. In ProDemnity's experience, when litigation looms, construction managers are often nowhere to be found. The general contractor was impervious to being served and was probably insolvent anyway. The defense was not going to be easy. To begin with, we were handicapped by the facts. The building was standing naked with its defects showing. The architect had visited the job on many occasions and had charged for his visits. He had issued interim and substantial certificates. He had no good excuse for not having seen some of the worst, clearly visible defects, such as the roof flashings and metal fascias. He had never bothered to check the exterior wall system for gross code violations. But we had a few cards to play. Our arguments were emotional and anecdotal, but they rang true and would carry some weight. The owner had behaved in a contentious and authoritarian manner, using the construction manager as his agent and treating the architect as an interloper on the site, denying him the very role in which he could have mitigated some of the errors. The general contractor had been terrorized and ruined. In addition, the economic loss that the owner claimed appeared insupportable in light of what was happening in the health resort industry, with bankruptcies becoming the norm. We felt that our defenses were strong in this area, seeing as there may have been no lost income, at least none that could be proven. Sometimes the cards we are dealt seem unplayable, but context is everything. In this case, ProDemnity had a weak hand, but the plaintiff had a weaker one. They had no time, creditors were at their heels, and the resort was going broke. We seized the opportunity to offer a settlement with the owner. In return for a full release, the owner would get some liquidity plus a little time, and we would sidestep a maximum claim. The alternative was to risk that a receiver or a purchaser would take over the resort and the action, with enough funds to see it to trial. This would have been calamitous for the architect, who had no excess insurance, and punishing for ProDemnity, which would have paid out the maximum amounts available under the coverage, in addition to certain legal and expense costs. Instead, a relatively modest settlement was paid and full releases were obtained. An analysis of the claim began with the steel stud exterior wall system, a construction method that is notoriously unforgiving of poor detailing and workmanship. In our opinion, these walls often present an unacceptable risk of failure. We see a large number of claims relating to steel stud exterior walls, and the worst are those with an exterior board plastered with stucco. Further to this, the owner's decision to fast-track the construction process and keep the architect off the site could only have led to problems sooner or later. The architect in this story remained oblivious to the valuable lessons that he might have learned. He believed to the end that he was without blame and entirely failed to understand his extreme good fortune. For the rest of us, three lessons leap to the fore. Lesson number one, across the board. In the Canadian climate, avoid steel stud exterior wall systems, especially those involving stucco on board. Lesson number two, to avoid exterior wall problems such as this, hire a building envelope specialist. Lesson number three, be wary when your responsibilities are shifted to construction managers who lack professional accreditation, insurance, and any semblance of appreciation for the architect's role in the construction process. There is one other obvious fact that architects would do well to remember. A building's form should somehow reflect its function. If you're designing a building dedicated to health, you would do well to avoid materials and methods that result in an unhealthy building. Thanks for listening to this edition of Claim Stories. We hope it was instructive and entertaining, as well as cautionary. Remember that every jurisdiction and every case is different.
Always refer to the laws and regulations governing your local jurisdiction and consult a legal, architectural, and insurance professional about the unique circumstances of your own case. The Prodemnity Claim Stories were originally written by David Croft. The audio episodes are read by Liam Gadsby and produced by Revelator Studio Toronto. The publisher and executive producer of the written stories and audio episodes is Prodemnity Insurance Company Toronto. For more information, including the full legal disclaimer, visit prodemnity.com.